If your brain is at full capacity with to-dos, birthdays, and dinner plans, meet Skylight Calendar. It syncs your entire family schedule onto a sleek digital display so you focus on important things like where you left your coffee. Right now, Skylight is offering our listeners $30 off their 15-inch calendars by going to skylightcal.com/talk. Go to skylightcal.com/talk for $30 off your 15-inch calendar. That's skylightcal.com/talk.
Men, if you're ready to reclaim your edge, listen up. I used to be held back by constant bathroom trips, with multiple wake-ups during my sleep and looking for restrooms whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Man. After just 2 months, I started experiencing fewer trips to the bathroom, less urge to go, and I even slept through some nights. I feel a noticeable boost in my overall well-being, even sexual stamina. It gives me the freedom and confidence to live life on my terms. Better Man is clinically tested and trusted by thousands of men over 25 years. Ready to take back control? Go to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com.
These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. We have two division previews left to go, and then no more until like 2021. But we are doing AFC North this week. I don't know. I think that's the extent of my intro, Andy. I'm just flat out stating the division we're going to do, and then we're going to do it.
It's very good. You know, the AFC North, Baltimore won it handily last year. And I've been going through and just kind of reviewing all these teams from last season, the film notes. That's what I do this time of year. And I'm looking at the Ravens. One thing I do is just kind of check where everybody ranked on everything. Yeah, it doesn't tell you the whole story, certainly. But Baltimore's offense ranked first in points, second in yards. And their defense was third in points and fourth in yards. I'm sure it's happened before. It's probably happened every several years. It's not often, though. A team ranking top three in both on both sides of the ball.
You know, I was actually, on top of that, I was looking at Football Outsiders' pressure metrics. Let me bring this up because I want to make sure I have it exactly right here. But, you know, you look at this. You look at this Ravens roster, and it's like, okay, well, there's not a ton of talent on the edge. They don't have Khalil Mack here. They ranked the first. That's the top. Number one is the highest you can be in adjusted pressure. So, yeah, they got it done last year.
Well, if I recall, because reading the Football Outsiders Almanac has become part of my review process as well. I think Aaron Schatz and those guys do a tremendous job. So I read what you read. If I recall, Baltimore was like middle of the pack in sacks or actual bottom line productivity on the pressure, the pass rush. But they got pressure so often, their pass defense ranks very high. One thing you see often with teams that blitz a lot, because Baltimore led the league in blitzes. They were first in number of 5 and 6 man rushes. They were 32nd in number of 4 man rushes. So they pretty much blitz or bring designer pressure more than they don't, or it's about an even split. When you get defenses like that, a lot of times you get a lot of pressure and a lot of incompletions, not necessarily sacks so much. And that was the old Rex Ryan philosophy. Remember those Jets defenses when the Jets were going to the AFC Championship, Darrell Revis was at his height. They didn't have blazing, amazing sack numbers, but their opponent's completion percentage was always around 50. So I want to say it was below that at times, because a blitz, the idea of the blitz more than to generate the sack, you'll take that. That's the best case scenario, but really you're trying to get the quarterback to play fast. And when a quarterback plays fast, he throws the ball faster. That's what quarterbacks do. So it's presenting the pressure and rushing the QB, and these blitzing defenses, really it's about incompletions more than sacks with the really good ones, which is part of the reason Baltimore has some high-level corners as well. You want guys covering one-on-one against those quick passes that just add to the cause.
Yeah, they also defensively, if we could just I love how we're just starting the show saying that the 14-2 team was good last year. They only had 17 takeaways in 2018. Like you mentioned, when you generate that pressure, it's incompletions, it's mistakes by the offense. You generally get a few more takeaways that way too. So they ranked tied for 22nd in 2018, and they moved all the way up to tied for 7th last year. So they got some things done.
Yeah, there you go. And, you know, the Marcus Peters trade mid-season, because he was involved in a few of those takeaways. He's become a really good corner. I thought that was a turning point for Baltimore, because it was obvious they're committing to man-to-man coverage. For years, they've been kind of a fire zone defense, where you're playing zone coverage, but only six guys back in coverage instead of the usual seven. You don't see fire zone a whole lot, because zones become bigger if there are only six defenders instead of seven. So what naturally happens with fire zones, because they have become more popular in the league in the last few years, but they take on the form of man-to-man coverage. If you have only six guys back in zone, the zones are so big, so you might as well match up to the guy who comes into your zone, because otherwise there's just too much space for the offense to use. So what Baltimore's done is basically transmogrify into this man-to-man defense. They start with fire zone, they do a lot of unique and unusual matchup designs from it, and they realize our corners are great, that's the strength of our team, let's just keep it a little simpler on ourselves and play straight man coverage. And I didn't think Peters would fit their style of play, to be perfectly frank. I didn't think he's not the most disciplined cornerback in terms of fundamentals. He's really much kind of a street baller type of feel player. He's not Kyle Fuller of the Bears, who's teach tape technique every snap. And so I didn't know if Peters would do well in a scheme that asked him to play a lot of straight man like that, or certainly matchup zone man coverages, because he likes to have his eyes on the QB. But I was wrong. And I would love to know exactly how they worked with him midseason. Marcus Peters was phenomenal for them last year.
So when you're looking at that defense, and we'll start with that side of the ball. We already did start. We'll just continue
on
that side of the ball.
Yeah, we are well into
the
show here. You're trying to bring us back to the intro. I took the show and just moved. You said you didn't have an intro. So, all right, well, let's just go then.
I know. I brought this on myself. So if you look at this defense, look, they fortified the defensive line. They bring in Calais Campbell. They bring in Derek Wolfe. The linebackers you'd look at, it's going to be the top three on the depth chart are all new guys. Two rookies. You got the first round pick Patrick Queen, the third round pick Malik Harrison. LJ Fort, a free agent they brought in, is probably the number three guy at this point. But in your mind, how problematic is it to have new and young linebackers in this Wink Martindale defense? Is this something to worry about?
It gets your attention, because there is some demands on the linebackers. You have to be able to do a lot of things besides play the run. And, you know, that's a fairly standard approach from team to team. Your run gaps are kind of your run gaps. And I think these guys will do very well, because Derek Wolfe, Brandon Williams, the only returning every down player pretty much, and then Calais Campbell, that might be the best three-man run-stopping tandem in the NFL. They're going to work great for what Baltimore does. So these linebackers will have some freedom with playing the run. I think they'll be clean of blockers pretty often. So when you get into the pass defense part of it, when you're a blitz-oriented team and you're built on disguises and you do still do fire zone, even though you're doing more man coverage, you're still going to play your fire zone stuff. Now you have linebackers that have to be able to rush and drop into coverage. And their rush is not just, hey, go get the quarterback. Baltimore's rushes on blitzes are highly schemed. You start out in one gap, but you blitz to the other gap. Other guys are crisscrossing. There's a lot to read there. So it's a tall order for these rookies. Now, I don't know if I've said on this podcast or not, I'm a big, big fan of Baltimore's linebacker coach, Mike McDonald. And, you know, the defensive coordinator, Wink Martindale, used to be the linebacker's coach. And I do think that matters sometimes. Martindale's going to understand how to help his rookie linebackers more than another defensive coordinator might. So you have that going for you. Patrick Queen's a first-round pick. Obviously, they feel he's very talented. Talent means something in the NFL. I don't know. Do you know much about Malik Harrison? I don't remember what the book on him is. Out of Ohio State, third-round pick.
Yeah, he's probably a guy who doesn't stay on the field in passing situations.
He's a thumper?
Yes, very much so.
Which is fine, because Baltimore last season they only put one linebacker on the field. They played a ton of dime defense. So they'll put a third safety out there, And I'm looking who their safeties are, because Chuck Clark's now the starter now that that Tony Jefferson's off the team. And Clark became the starter last year when Jefferson got hurt. But it's, you want to know who that third safety is. It's either going to be Anthony Levine or Deshaun Elliott, who was looking pretty good before he got hurt last year. That third safety basically plays linebacker is what I'm getting at. That guy, and sometimes Clark becomes a linebacker in this scenario. But they're going to play dime, put a safety at linebacker, more speed on the field, coverage, flexibility, all that stuff. So they don't need a ton of linebacking depth. And if they do have to go to somebody, you know, LJ Fort, quietly, Gary, he's been a really good, solid backup linebacker in the NFL for a long, not a long time, but the last several years, he's been a good player for the Steelers and then last season Philadelphia and Baltimore.
Let's talk offensive side of the ball. I'll just leave it very very vague in general here for you, Andy. Is there any real concern about this offense being sustainable going forward?
Yes and no. The yes part in that I don't think you can count on defenses being caught as off guard and flat-footed against your run designs as they were a year ago. One thing that was interesting with Baltimore, and it was one of the greatest running games of all time. Statistically, it was the greatest of all time. So do not take this at all as a significant negative, but you did notice they were much, it felt like they were more effective early in games and late in games sometimes with their scheming. Baltimore puts a lot of moving pieces in front of you, a lot of pull blockers, a lot of motion. I think 70% of their run plays had some kind of motion at the snap. So not only are you shifting and moving guys, but when the ball's being snapped, you're doing that. That's extremely difficult to deal with on run plays because it changes everyone's gap assignment on the fly. And then, of course, the guy holding the ball and orchestrating all of this once the ball snapped is Lamar Jackson, and that presents a lot of problems as well. So it's still going to be a top three running game no matter what. Can you count on it getting 206 yards a game like it did a year ago? I don't know if any team should go into a season relying on that. So then the question is, all right, well, what about the passing game and where does that stand? One thing I really have, I like a lot about Lamar Jackson, Gary, is that he's a quarterback first. And if anybody could get away with being just a run-oriented mobile guy, you'd think it'd be him. He's always been able to run away from people. Even now that he's in the NFL, he can run away from people. It's remarkable he's developed as much discipline as he has to remain a passer because their passing game is extremely well-designed as well, especially when they get into the high red zone area. And Jackson had a ton of TDs from the pocket last year. He does not break himself down and scramble very much. He needs to get a little bit quicker and spot at reading the field, which is to be expected for a guy of his age. And I think he's ahead of where most guys would be in their careers if they were playing as much as he's played. So there's optimism for their passing game being better than it was a year ago. One thing that gives me concern is Hayden Hurst was not a difference maker in and of himself, but most defenses treated him as their number one tight end, even though Mark Andrews is probably the guy we all would agree is their best receiving tight end, certainly. Yeah. Hurst drew a lot of unique attention, and Baltimore is able to throw the ball out of two tight end and especially three tight end formations because of Hurst. They're down that guy. So now they don't have the same kind of tight end depth as last year. They'll have to ask more of their wide receivers, which means a little bit less creativity in some spots in your passing game.
Let's move on to the Pittsburgh Steelers, and well, since I didn't do the intro this week, I should remind everyone we are not going by the order of our projected standings here. We are going by order of last year's standings. We will, however, have projections at the end of this show. So Steelers were second place last year, just missed the playoffs. Obviously, had there been a seventh seed in the league, it would have been the Pittsburgh Steelers. But let's start on the offensive side of the ball with them. I mean, look, their receivers were not good last season. Juju Smith-Schuster slid back a little bit. Obviously, it was the first year in forever without Antonio Brown there. But also quarterback problems. Now you got Ben Roethlisberger back. Do they have to change how they approach this offensively as far as the passing game goes? Do they have to do something to help these guys out to get open?
Well, I think Roethlisberger, in his heart of hearts, even though I've argued for years he's the most evolved quarterback of our time, because he started out as just a true sandlot type of QB, and he's evolved into this pretty shrewd pre-snap guy. That's, they like to spread out into empty and let him read the defense before the snap and make quick decisions right after it. As a result, you know, that's, he's capable of doing that. I still think at his core, in his bone marrow, he is that sandlot QB still. And so that will help the receivers. I do think the receivers need to do more to help him. And if they're not capable of that, those wide receivers cannot do that. And that's a genuine question. You know, James Washington, I know we like him more than we did this time a year ago. Jury's still out. Deontay Johnson, same story. Chase Claypool's a pretty polarizing second-round rookie receiver for draft evaluations coming out. If those guys struggle, and they did for more, they have more than they haven't, then you've got to do more with the scheme to help get them open. You can't line up and have guys play on an island if they can't win on an island. Your wide receivers have to be able to win. If they don't, the scheme has to help you. And I think bridging those two things is something Pittsburgh has been hot and cold with in the last few years. Roethlisberger lets them get away with that. When they went to the backup QBs, that got exposed a little bit more. It's still something to correct and address. You want to be your best version of yourselves, and to just spin the ball out there and hope Big Ben makes a play, that can't be enough. That's not enough, especially if Antonio Brown and Le'Veon Bell are no longer here.
Yeah. Defense side of the ball. Defense obviously is what carried them a year ago. Did they do anything different? What changed when Micah Fitzpatrick came in, besides the fact that they just added a better player to the secondary?
Well, they added a better player in a spot that has a lot of trickle-down effect. Because when you're better at safety, he's more instinctive. He has a chance to react to more plays than other safeties had been for them. And I think that does make other guys around him that much better, and offenses are more aware of the free safety. So that's a little bit of a factor there. There was this idea that Fitzpatrick was very interchangeable initially. Oh, he played down in the box. He played back deep. He's that linebacker. We heard about that. That's the nature of the scheme. Every safety does that in almost every scheme in the NFL, and especially one like Pittsburgh's, where they're similar to Baltimore in that it's going to be fire zone pressure as their kind of their third down foundation. They don't just line up and keep it in front of them. They are attack-minded very often as a defense. So having a safety like that just makes you that much better in all those things. There were two guys that I thought were really important for how this secondary evolved. One is Terrell Edmonds got better. He's room to grow still, but he took a nice step forward in year two. And the guy that no one talked about was Joe Hayden last year. Joe Hayden, to me, was one of the 10 best cornerbacks in the NFL. And I don't know what his advanced stats say. I want to say that it did not reflect that. I've watched every snap he's taken. I've watched all the big plays. I've talked to other coaches that faced him. Joe Hayden had a phenomenal season. He's not a shutdown perfect corner, but he was a big play corner a year ago. And having Hayden improve with Fitzpatrick, those are two all-pro level talents almost. Certainly Pro Bowl level talents.
Yeah, I mean, Hayden's been sort of overlooked for quite a while now. I feel like he's never really in that conversation for being an all-pro guy or anything like that. Second team, obviously. I don't know if that affects people's thoughts on him. The cornerbacking group, I don't know. Like you said, Hayden, underappreciated, really good player. After that, you just go down the line. You know, Mike Hilton, effective blitzer out of the slot. Steven Nelson. Steven Nelson is one of those guys where it feels like he can be a little bit feast or famine with a streaky number two cornerback.
He was streaky in the right direction a lot last year, though. He was better than he was as a Chief. Which would make me wrong about him. I thought that'd be a problem. I didn't like him very much in Kansas City, to be honest. But he played very well outside for them. Vertical routes at the right corner spot is where Nelson's run hot and cold. He was better last year there.
Yeah. Yeah, and look, they generate pressure here in Pittsburgh. That was not always the case in Kansas City when he was there. So maybe that gives him a little boost as well.
One other thing, you mentioned Mike Hilton. The Steelers are one of the few teams that rotate at the slot cornerback position. In fact, they might be the only team that does that. Mike Hilton plays... on possible run situations. So if you're in 11 personnel, three wide receivers, it's first and 10. The Steelers are going to have Mike Hilton on the field because they want his run defense in there. And some of those slot blitzes you bring, those can serve as good run defending tactics depending on the nature of the opponent's run game. So you blitz and you're rushing five, and I guess you're being aggressive, but it's a form of run defense as much as anything. In obvious pass situations for about 10 or 12 snaps a game where it's a third and long type of deal, they were playing Cameron Sutton in the slot quite a bit last year. That surprises me. I think Hilton's a very good player. Obviously, they feel Sutton's the better coverage guy. But just something to note about the Steelers is they're one of the few teams that rotate at that slot cornerback position. They want to be a nickel defense where they have two linebackers on the field, but they just haven't quite consistently had two linebackers available. And I think I'm looking now, is Mark Barron no longer on their roster? Is he not here this year, or am I missing something?
No, he is elsewhere. Possibly nowhere at this point.
Yeah, I'm going to Google Mark Barron real fast. Because Mark Barron was brought in to be that number two cover linebacker. So he actually rotates in as well as part of the sub packages. But if Mark Barron is not here, and he is a free agent right now, that tells me they're probably going to play dime again. Bush will be the every down linebacker for him, and he's ready for that role, Devin Bush. But they don't have a lot of linebacking depth otherwise.
All right, let's head out to Cleveland, and we're going to get to Baker Mayfield and all that in just a minute here. But I don't know if we've talked about the Browns' defense throughout this entire offseason here, Andy, and we probably should at some point because they're gonna play like half of these games for the Browns. So, new defensive coordinator Joe Woods comes in. How is this group gonna look different than it did a year ago?
Well, Joe Woods, his background's somewhat diverse. Most recently, he's of the 49ers. So that cover three, fast-paced kind of defense. And I do think Cleveland, their D-line's not as good as San Francisco's was last year, but I do think they've got enough juice to play that way. If you're going to play cover three and just be a speed-oriented defense, your four-man rush has to get pressure. They feel Myles Garrett can do that, a very violent edge rusher. They probably need a number two edge rusher. Olivier Vernon's still a phenomenal run defender. I don't know if he's quite an edge bender. But then inside, Larry Ogunjobi and Sheldon Richardson, that's a plus pass rush inside. Adrian Claiborne's your best guy off the bench. So it's not a dazzling pass rush, but I think it is just good enough to let them at least try to play the way they want to play and do some of those 49er-type zone coverages, if that's what they indeed do. The concern with the defense is that their linebacker situation is very up in the air, and now Mack Wilson looks like he's going to be out for a long time. He was their only returning starter, and there was questions about him still coming in. He's a young guy. He's not a natural cover guy necessarily. You can't play cover three if your linebackers can't run and cover. It's not going to work. So the other guy they have that's running this defense, their pass game coordinator on defense, is Jeff Howard, who came over from Minnesota with Kevin Stefanski. So Howard's background is in that Mike Zimmer stuff, those split safety looks, cover four, basically, which a lot of times the way the Niners play cover three, it's not super dissimilar from cover four. Suffice it to say, the safeties play low and aggressive, and they have vertical defense responsibilities kind of near the seams. Your corners have to cover one-on-one outside a lot of the time. So it's going to be cover three or cover four, Gary, one of those two. I've asked people with the Browns, and you know they won't tell me. They're not going to. They refuse to tell me what they're going to do this year, which wounded me a little bit. If I'm being perfectly, very rude, very rude. But you know they probably knew we hadn't done the AFC North podcast yet. You never know. I'll be eager to see what they do, and my guess is they're not married to either approach quite yet because they've got questions, certainly at linebacker, like we touched on. They're not very deep at safety, so they have questions at safety as well. So that might dictate what they wind up doing.
Yeah, it's a thin group there in Cleveland. We'll see how they hold up this year. But offensive side of the ball, you know, you've mentioned a couple times Baker Mayfield wasn't really seeing the field with the same kind of clarity last year as he did as a rookie. What can Kevin Stefanski do to sort of make this a little bit better, a little bit easier on Baker?
Well, statistically, there was an enormous difference in Mayfield when he was passing out of play action versus when he was passing just drop back, which is true of a lot of teams. A lot of teams are going to have better play action numbers because it's kind of the nature of the play action game a little bit. Those passes come on run down, so predictable defense means you're going to be able to kind of attack downfield a little more because you know where the safeties will be. So some of that's just the nature of things, but I do think Mayfield's one of those QBs who probably is better in a balanced run-oriented system, even though he came out of Oklahoma in that spread offense and he slung the ball all over the field. And look, he can probably do that at times in the NFL, but where he's at his best, he's probably one of those guys that needs to have a little bit of discipline instilled upon him. He probably need to regulate him. I'm not at all saying he's a reckless player. He was at times last year. He needs to be better in that sense. I think he's a good quarterback, but he probably needs some discipline instilled upon him, which is what you do with the system. You don't just tell him to take care of the ball. You put him in situations and call plays that make that a little more conducive and natural. So Stefanski ran a ton of play action in Minnesota. They were one of the only teams that really played out of base personnel more than 11 personnel. So two backs or two tight ends on the field, sometimes both. And it's very clear, Gary, that's what they're going to try to do in Cleveland, because they didn't really go after any wide receivers of note this offseason. Mm-hmm. They did, however, sign Andy Janovich at fullback from Denver. And they you know, Kareem Hunt is back along with Nick Chubb, so they have two backs there. And then they paid big money, really big money in my opinion, for Austin Hooper. And they did not trade David Njoku, even though he fits every form of the profile of a guy that usually gets traded based on how things have gone so far. They kept him around because they need him to be Irv Smith this year. So they're going to play like Stefanski did with Minnesota and have a simpler offense that starts with the run game, and I think Mayfield will be better for that.
All right, let's go to the Bengals. Rookie quarterback, short, weird offseason. You look back at 2011, the last time we had sort of a truncated offseason here, a training camp session for these guys, and that was Cam Newton's rookie year, that was Andy Dalton's rookie year, and then you had kind of a mixed bag with the Locker, Gabbert, Ponder in between those two. But you did see some quarterbacks have success even with the weird offseason in 2011 because of the CBA negotiations.
Yep.
But the Bengals, rookie quarterback, weird offseason. I don't know. Is this built for Joe Burrow to have early success?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I like the system. It's that Titans/Niners/Packers/Rams style of offense. Start with the outside zone, kind of that Brown style of offense too a little bit. Start with the run game, make them defend your run game, and then have your pass concepts come off of that. So you take some pressure off the QB when you play that way. Joe Burrow will see some looks that he's seen before. Now, you know, it's still the NFL. It's still an adjustment. You're going to have to be comfortable playing with your back to the defense at times, turning your back to the defense if you're going to be a play action offense. I don't know if Burrow, do you know if he did that a lot at LSU? My guess is he probably didn't have to. They were so talented at wide receiver. I bet he lined up in shotgun a lot and just read the field. Is that how he played?
Yeah, I don't picture in my mind's eye a whole lot of play action going on with that LSU offense.
So, you know, and every young QB is going to have something to learn. Now, those guys you mentioned in 2011 that worked out well, we don't know if that was anything to do with the lockout or not. I mean, Andy Dalton went on to have a solid career. Cam Newton went on to have a nice career. Jake Locker went on to be nothing. And Christian Ponder went on to be nothing. So even when they had off seasons in other years, they weren't any good. So I don't know if that, you know, that I looked up that 2011 lockout year, Gary. I'm going to pull up my phone as we're doing this because I texted this with someone. But I wanted to see, because I do think the lack of practice time means something this year. And these teams that have their staffs coming back, that's a big difference. But when I looked into that 2011 lockout year, the numbers really didn't bear that out a whole lot. The teams that were, in fact, if anything, some of the teams with new coaching staffs had better success than some of the teams that had been there before.
Mm-hmm.
Need to say something while I try to pull up the specifics here on my phone. You need to buy some time.
I know. I was hoping you would buy more time because I'm trying to look up LSU's play action rate from last year.
Are you? That's awfully specific.
They were relatively high. They were, what is this? I'm going off of teamrankings.com's numbers here. They were top 25 in play action rate last year. So,
All right.
There's a thing.
So, and look, if they're a shotgun offense, sometimes that's just the timing of the play. I mean, they probably were a play-action offense if that's what the numbers say. But there are certain play-action concepts, and I don't know if it's more common in college or not, where they're not really running play. Really, we ought to call it run action. If the QB kind of just gives a token fake handoff to the running back, that's not really play action. It's where your run game, it's where the linemen have to be selling the run play for it to truly be play action, in my mind.
Okay.
So look up how many times the linemen sold those run plays. Can you Google that one?
I'll watch a mashup of every play, every snap they ran last year real quick.
I found the stats. So 7 new head coaches in 2011. So that year, the lockout. So they didn't have these offseason practices, just same scenarios this year. 5 of those 7 coaches won more games in 2011 than the previous year's team. So if I was a new head coach for the Panthers, I won more games with the Panthers in 2011 than the 2010 Panthers. So the teams that hired new coaches got better. 4 of them won at least 4 more games than the previous year's team, which I'd say that's a huge significant increase. And then 4 of the 7 new head coaches started 3 or better early in the season. So if we're just reducing this to wins and losses, which is probably oversimplifying, but probably not, because at the end of the day, that's what we're doing is wins and losses. You know, the teams that had new coaches last year, or last time we saw a season with no offseason, it really didn't reflect negatively in the win-loss record.
Yeah, I will say, if I could just call you out,
yes,
which is what I love to do. I would think most new coaches have a better record than the previous year because the guy got fired for having a bad record.
That's a great point. So the better stat then would be what percent of coaches in their first year have a better record than the previous year's team, and then we have to relate it to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, that sounds like a Ryan Taylor project to me. I don't want to do all that work, but Ryan does do these things when we mention these casually on the podcast. I feel like we're kind of manipulating the poor guy.
I was just going to say, we've already taken a couple breaks during this segment. I think perhaps we just take like a 20-minute break, just run some dead air for a while, and we can look it up ourselves.
So if Ryan does indeed do this to save him some time, why don't we say in the 2000s? Just look at all the head coaches in the 2000s. Even then, I mean, it's maybe since 2010.
Okay.
Save him a little time. That gives us, because that reflects more of a current era for football. How does changing your head coach, typically what can you expect for in terms of wins and losses? Because, yes, you change head coaches if you don't have enough wins, so it's easy to improve the next year in your win total in that sense. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of teams that also just hit the reset button altogether. Carolina, how many games did Carolina win last year? Carolina Panthers.
Not many. They'll probably win fewer this year, though, because they really tore it down.
Yeah, exactly. Now I'm curious.
They were 5-11.
Okay, we watch all these things, and I remember all the stuff, all these teams, and I don't think to remember the actual wins and losses. I look up records so many times because you don't think about teams with their bottom line win and loss records when you start getting in the weeds with them. 5-11 confirmed. Yeah, I mean 5-11, 5-11 would be a very successful season for Carolina right now with where they are.
God, the two of us, we're just terrible researchers.
How many games did the Lions win?
They were 3-12-1. I know that for a fact. I know they were 3-4-1 with Stafford because I was campaigning for Matthew Stafford as the sub-500 MVP of the league before he got hurt.
I'm going to give you one more just to see if I can trip you up. What would you guess Minnesota's record was? Answer quickly.
10-6, but that is just a guess.
I thought theirs would be misleading because I think they were 10-4. And then they had a meaningless Week 17 game. So really, they played more like an 11-5 type of team all year. And 11-5, 10-6 doesn't feel like a big difference, except in some ways it sort of does. Because when I hear 10-6, I think wild card team. And 11-5, you kind of instinctively think division winner, even though I don't know if it goes that way very consistently.
Yeah, I was going to say, Vikings are a little bit tricky as well because the Packers, of course, won 13 games last year, as I have been reminded all week since... since writing not even that negative scouting report on their team, but just sort of pointing out maybe they weren't 13 win caliber. Maybe that wouldn't have repeated itself if they replayed that entire season. But they were 13-3, so Vikings could have been 12-4. And
are Packer fans being vicious to you? Because I will admit I have never met a disrespectful Packer fan.
Is that true, or are you being sarcastic?
No, I'm not. I mean, I could see why that would sound sarcastic to someone that has met one. But I've always had great interactions with Packer fans.
They are enthusiastic.
Well,
how's that?
Okay, that's fandom, but it's like, you know, let's just call a spade a spade. If you get an email from an Eagles fan or a Raiders fan, certainly, or maybe even a Jets fan, and it's a negative email, you can expect there's going to be some oomph behind that. It's they're going to pack a punch. I don't think Green Bay is one of those teams.
One thing I've found about Packers fans is that they like the Packers.
Yeah, and that's a common trait with a lot of teams and their fans.
Yeah.
Teams I just mentioned, the fans don't always seem to like the team.
that's actually a good point. There are some people who just like to be miserable with this stuff. Jets fans.
Yeah.
All right. Bengals. We still have to do the defensive side of the ball here for the Bengals. Look, they have clearly invested in athleticism at the linebacker position. They have pretty heavily revamped the cornerbacking group that they have. Trey Wayne's in dealing with some injury stuff right now. They go and get Mackenzie Alexander to go along with William Jackson. I mean, are they building this more like a Lou Anarumo defense here, or is this just kind of a matter of they just didn't have the talent, and now they are just trying to get some sort of, you know, baseline league capable guys here?
Well, at linebacker, it was they didn't have the talent. I mean, I was almost a little offended that I didn't get a call and a chance to try out for their linebacker unit last season. There was plenty of room to get better there. Cornerback, maybe a little bit of a different story. You know, they had some injuries last year. They replaced some guys, kind of just a change of an era. You know, Trey Wayne's, Gary, that injury he has, I've heard reports that he might not play this year. Right? He's going to be out for a while. If that's the case, that's a big deal. Trey Waynes was their hallmark acquisition this offseason. Now, they still have William Jackson. Mackenzie Alexander, to me, is strictly a slot guy, which raises the question, who's your number two corners? Darius Phillips, maybe the outside guy, and he's been more of a slot guy, too, I want to say. You know, corner's a problem for them. They're a zone-based defense, so that helps, but you know, their safeties, they did sign Von Bell. And so Sean Williams, I think, got hurt too lately. And the Von Bell acquisition becomes more important than if Sean, I'm going to make sure Sean Williams is indeed hurt. You know, it's not a great secondary overall, if we're just being honest. It might be better than it was a year ago, and it's going in the right direction. What this team needs is this defensive line to play at a very high level. And this defensive line for several years now has been, given its level of talent, it's been a very inconsistent group.
All right. With that, I think it's time for projections. Any final arguments before we move on to projections?
No, it looks like Sean Williams, it looks like report could be he'll be back before the opener. So training camp injury, which is good news. That's nice. And they might wind up playing. You know, they did play a little more dime as well last year. They've always been a nickel defense, but it's a different coaching staff now. They played some dime, so a guy like Sean Williams could be a big deal. Last note on the Bengals end, I would be very surprised if Josh Bynes does not wind up becoming their starting linebacker, maybe their every down linebacker. He's slated for the second team. Yeah, because Josh Bynes is one of those guys, every team signs him and they wind up realizing, man, for one, this guy runs better than we thought he would. And for two, he knows what the hell he's doing out there. He's a smart, disciplined player. He's been a good player everywhere he's gone, and for whatever reason, he's always having to go somewhere else. He's not being brought back. Josh Bynes, I bet you, will be their most stable linebacker in 2020 just because he's done that so many times before.
If you're a Bengals fan, do you feel good about that, or is that discouraging?
I mean it in a positive way. Okay. I don't mean it in the way like, oh, they're going to have to fall back on Josh Bynes. I mean it in the way that... yeah, Bynes probably does get on the field if something negative happens, but he so stabilizes things. He's so reliable that once he's in there, you forgot there was ever a problem to begin with. He doesn't change everything. He's not going to light the world on fire. He's just going to solve your problems.
Now, the projections. Are you? I'm picking the Ravens to win this division. Are you also picking the Ravens?
No, I got the Bengals because they got Josh Bynes. And then after the Bengals, I guess I'd probably go. You have to go. You have to project Baltimore one still. It's going to be hard for them to be at the level they were last year. I mean, what 14-2, top three, both sides of the ball. But that doesn't, you know, they could fall to 12-4 and still be a Super Bowl contender. So yeah, I'm going Baltimore one. Who do we have at two? We don't have to agree necessarily, but who's two?
I'm going Pittsburgh two. I do want to make this point about Pittsburgh, and you mentioned, you know, does Baltimore fall off? They rank so high. I always look at takeaways year to year, and takeaways, look, they're loosely related to pressure. It's not purely a luck category, but luck does have a lot to do with it. And I did this last year with the Bears. And early in the season, I pointed out the Bears led the league with 36 takeaways in 2018, and they probably couldn't do that again, even though they do have a good group. They fell all the way to 22nd in the league with 19. If you look back, our StatSync data only goes back to 1995, but there's in that span, going back to 1995, there's never been a team lead the league in takeaways back-to-back year. And in fact, only one team led the league and then finished top five the next year, and that was, of course, as we all know, the 2010 Giants, who tied for fifth after leading in that's the 2011 Giants, tied for fifth after leading in the 2010 season. So
that 2011 Giants team won the Super Bowl that year too.
They did. So they were the one success story here as far as takeaway consistency. So that's my way of saying Steelers led the league with 38 takeaways last year. They are probably going to get a fair amount of takeaways. They're probably not going to get 38. And I feel like they just kind of, boy, if you had that kind of defensive season with their 2018 team, you really had something there. You had a, you know, 13 win season there. I think the takeaways go away. I think the defense goes from, one or two best in the league to maybe the fifth or sixth best in the league. And I think that's enough that they don't catch Baltimore, even if Ben Roethlisberger does sort of figure it out with this group of receivers.
I think that's fair. I mean, I know you're not saying this, but I always feel like someone needs to just throw caution here and say, you know, what they did in 2019 for takeaways is not relevant directly to 2020. It's totally two separate things, but your point has a lot of history behind it, and it's a good one. Let's put it, maybe we can agree on it this way. Your plan can't be to win to force a lot of turnovers. You can't be reliant on that. That's a turnover is a byproduct of how you play, or it is an effect, but all you can really control is the cause. How do we play? What do we do? And trust that the turnovers take care of themselves. Saying we're going to force a lot of turnovers, that's almost the equivalent of going in and like, all right, guys, our plan today is to score a lot of touchdowns. That's not your plan. You have to play at a certain level.
I agree with that. Yes.
So, anyone would, because it's not like an opinion that we're just stating the logic of it. But it's easy to forget that these, you know, you don't want to analyze the results. The results are just the results. The process is good. I think Pittsburgh's process will be excellent this season. We didn't talk about their D-line, but it's up there. It's one of the better defensive lines in the NFL still. We do like their secondary a lot. This has a chance to be one of the, I don't know where they'll rank, but this has a chance to be one of the five or six best defenses in the NFL, and I think that's how this team will have to play. I don't think they have an offense that can score 30 a game, or at least they can score 30 on any given game, but I don't think they can score 30 a game week in and week out. That's a big difference.
I will say, I thought Lamar Jackson's worst game of 2019 was when he went to Pittsburgh. I want to say it was probably like early October last year.
And then, of course, week five. I remember because I watched the film late Friday night with my nephew who was in town. And my nephew kept interjecting about, hey, you know, hey, watch this, watch that. And he's 11 years old. He's 12 years old. And he kept saying, watch. Oh, now, hold on. Pause it. Watch number eight. Watch number eight. And I kept saying, you mean Lamar Jackson, the quarterback? So, yeah, anyway, it was week five. It was in October, week five. We'd just gotten back from Denny's.
Oh, man. Well, they didn't get a second shot because he did not play the Week 17 game, which was meaningless for the Ravens. It was RG3 in that game. So
yeah, and the Ravens still won that contest, and the Steelers needed that game. Jackson played poorly against Pittsburgh that day. You're right. It was his last time he threw interceptions. He had three in that game. I want to say they were all his fault to some degree. There was one that was a tremendous play. I forget who made it. But he didn't have any turnovers hardly at all after that the rest of the way. And if you'd said after that game that, hey, this Jackson's going to win MVP, that would not have made sense at the time.
Correct. Yeah, look, by midseason, he was not the league MVP. He was having a really good season, and then he just took off in the second half and very rightfully ran away with the award. I have Pittsburgh in front of Cleveland. I don't know. I don't trust that Cleveland defense, and I don't trust that the offense is going to completely take off and I was going to say get back to the level they played at in 2018, but that wasn't that high a level.
Yeah, they're not going in this year saying that's our, you know, let's climb that 2018 mountain. It's a team in transition. It's a team in transition for sure. And I just hope that, you hope ownership understands that in this case, because it's been a pretty quick trigger finger with the Haslam family and changing leadership with that organization, changing coaches. Because the expectation and kind of the natural sentiment is going to be new young offensive coach Kevin Stefanski. Wow, is he Matt Nagy? Is he Sean McVay? Is he Matt LaFleur? And it's Baker Mayfield. We have high expectations for Mayfield because he's on TV on these commercials now. It's a team in transition. If they go 9-7, that's a tremendous step forward. And I think that's going to be a tall order for them, even though I do think they're doing it the right way and they're going in the right direction as a franchise.
Non-Lamar Jacksons, who's your who are you circling for the MVP race?
Well, could Roethlisberger get in the conversation? He'll be the Phillip Rivers deal where he's going to get labeled comeback player of the year again.
That's probably true.
Yep. And there have been – he's never won an MVP, right?
Correct.
Has he come close? I mean, there's been years that I'm sure he's belonged in the discussion.
I don't remember him ever being really heavily in the discussion. I wouldn't be surprised if he had a Russell Wilson type thing where he's never gotten a vote for it.
Yeah, that's right. Russell Wilson has not. Isn't that funny? I mean, not funny, but like, isn't that just bizarre?
Yeah,
you could win a lot of bar bets on that trivia question with the Russell Wilson one.
Well, not anymore because.
You just
now that now that we've said it, it has reached a threshold that everyone knows it. But I mean, it's just, you know, it's about when did you have your best season? Oh, you had your best season when Tom Brady threw 50 touchdowns and the Patriots went 16-0. Well, no one's going to vote for you. There's only that's the thing with the NFL MVP voting. Everyone votes for one guy. It's not like the MLB style where you fill out your ballot with 10.
I know our friend Peter King, I think, is trying to get that changed. Yeah, I know he has been in his columns.
Yeah, so. I mean, it would be neat. I think they should change it, but I guess I really don't feel that strongly about it anyway.
Okay. So non-Lamar Jackson MVP, Mayfield, obviously if they do well, he'll be in that conversation. But let's go non-quarterback. Who would be the non-quarterback?
I don't know. I mean, are you talking about like T.J. Watt, Miles Garrett? I would probably take Watt before I took Garrett in that race.
If T.J.'s brother didn't get it any of those years, T.J.'s not going to get it. Not because he wouldn't deserve it, but voters aren't going to give it to a defensive guy.
Odell is probably the best non-quarterback offensive player in the division.
Yep, that's probably correct. You know, one thing, it's not going to get it, but kind of along the lines of the Mitch Morse conversation a few weeks ago.
Who gets the Mitch Morse Award for the AFC North?
I want to say Ronnie Stanley is an excellent tackle. So is Orlando Brown at right tackle, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Now, I don't think the nature of Baltimore's scheme is not as dependent on the O-line as other schemes, because so much of what Baltimore does with the run game hinges on misdirection, deception, making defenders be wrong when they're covering air, so to speak. No run play works if your left tackle doesn't block his guy, though, so let's not take this too far. So I'm not sure you could say that Stanley is an MVP for lineman caliber type deal, but the point I want to make is Baltimore often, even though they're this team that puts all these tight ends on the field, all these fullbacks, you'd think they'd have a passing game that derives from that, and they kind of do, but they often block with five in the passing game. They get five eligibles out in routes, which is not at all how you would guess a team like theirs plays. And I don't know if the numbers reflect that. I know all I know is there are every week there were significant snaps where it was very clear that they were pass protecting with just five and they felt fine doing that. That's a very good commentary on Ronnie Stanley and Orlando Brown at offensive tackle.
You know, Joe Burrow is 80-1. Only 80-1. That's for a rookie quarterback. I mean,
when's the last time a rookie won the MVP?
I don't think ever, right? In the NFL?
Is that true?
Ichiro, Fred Lynn.
Did Ichiro win one, dear? Did Ichiro get enough bunts and get on base to win the MVP one year?
Ichiro won it, right? Are you not an Ichiro guy?
No, I am. I remember at the time when he won it. He was just, if Ichiro, maybe I am exposing my baseball ignorance here, and if I am, I guess the baseball fans are welcome to tell me. There's an unwritten rule not to expose your baseball ignorance with baseball fans, I guess. But Ichiro, if he were a quarterback, he would have run a spread offense, and his average yards per completion would have been like 4. Completion percentage, 75, dink and dunk offense.
It's fair. I'll give you that. Okay.
All right,
but then he also played a good linebacker on the other side. I mean, that's a sport. Unlike these other sports, that's a sport where you got to play offense and defense.
Yeah, every so often you do.
Yeah.
I've been wanting to tweet this, but it never comes out right in a tweet. This whole baseball unwritten rules thing, which has kind of been a conversation because I guess who was the guy that hit a 3-0
Fernando
ball?
Fernando Tatis Jr. Yeah,
not allowed to swing if it's 3-0. You know, this doesn't happen in other sports. The difference is in baseball, there's so much idle time and standing around. And just think of how you behave. Anytime you got just time on your hands, you just stand there thinking about stuff. And I don't want to say it's out of boredom, because I'm sure the guys are more dialed in than that. But there's plenty of time to just kind of sit around and think up stuff. And when you think of stuff, it's much easier to find slights and feel like you've been rubbed the wrong way. You know, football doesn't have this garbage of unwritten rules very much because you're on to the next play doing something.
I think that's fair. Whenever I think of unwritten rules in baseball, the closest thing I can think of in the NFL is, you remember the old Shiano rushing the kneel down?
I do. And that's been highly debated within the league still. Some coaches feel like, yeah, you don't do that. I was fine with that because if you force the fumble on the exchange, which is, I think, what they were trying to do, they were diving at the A-gaps. Not every guy, if I have to go back and look at that play, but not every guy was diving at his offensive lineman. The guys in the A-gaps were, because that's the only chance you'd have it going and getting the ball. I could be wrong. There are coaches in the league that hated that.
I will say, in response to that thing that happened 7 years ago, what the NFL has to do, kind of like, you know, how MLB does intentional walks, they don't make you throw. You might not know this. They don't make you throw 4 pitches to intentionally walk a guy. You can just say you're intentionally walking a guy. And
right,
that's
a recent rule adjustment.
Yep, you can skip the theatrics, the excitement of the intentional walk. The NFL should, just to avoid any of that, and frankly to avoid the just dullness of kneel down, wait 40 seconds, kneel down, just say the offense should have a chance to basically just say, we're not going to run a play. Run 40 seconds off the clock. We're not going to run a play. The other team has timeouts. They can use a timeout to prevent that 40-second runoff, but just do it that way. Let's all move on with our lives.
It would speed up games, for sure. You'd only be able to do it in the fourth quarter because I think offenses would want the chance to fake the kneel down in the first half.
I think you could do it either way.
Well, no, but if you're an offense, what would be your motivation for that?
You might not be motivated to do it in the first half.
All right, I guess so. Yeah.
It's up to it's freedom of choice at that point. So
it's not a bad idea. I could see it also though being a slippery slope. It's like, well, okay, if that play's not important enough, we can just declare we're skipping it. What else? What do we declare we're skipping next?
Every team just show up with like 10 plays they want to run over the course of 20 minutes, and let's get out of here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Burrow yet? So Joe Burrow probably going to win MVP. 80 to, I just want to say 80 to 1 is that's surprisingly short odds for a rookie. And I don't know. I tried to look for a rookie NFL MVP and I didn't find one.
Okay.
Brian Taylor has to join us or something. Defensive player of the year, are you a TJ Watt guy? Are you a Myles Garrett guy? I guess Minkah Fitzpatrick you could put in that conversation. He'll have to have
like 7 or 8 interceptions for anyone to appreciate him though.
Can the Ravens get in on it? I mean, Stephon Gilmore won it a year ago. Can a Marlon Humphrey rise to that level this year?
Possibly. I liked him a lot last season. I've heard mixed reviews within the league on him, which baffles me because I think he's an outstanding corner, and I don't know how you could see it differently, but people I respect a lot do see it differently with him. But when he moved to the slot last season, which he did after Marcus Peters came along, that was he was outstanding there. And he is a big, strong, physical cornerback, which you don't get in the slot a whole lot. Now, I don't know if he'll do that this year because Jimmy Smith is moving from right corner to probably number three safety. And the number three safety role is a big role for them. That's what Brandon Carr played last year, and that's the guy who covers tight ends man-to-man. So, and Jimmy Smith, I think, is suited for that. I think he's going to do very well with that. Assuming what will be different is Smith will now have to play inside because that's where tight ends are going to line up. And Jimmy Smith has always played not just outside but on the right side because he's not a comfortable corner in other spots. So he has to now become a comfortable corner. They'll probably play more man coverage because of that, because most likely Smith's discomfort stems from some of the zone reads, I would guess. I don't know that, but that's the likely answer. So anyway, you know, I don't know if Humphrey will play inside this year because the Ravens are probably going to need a slot corner. Maybe it's Tavon Young if he's healthy. Humphrey's their best player, but that's going to be hard for people to fully appreciate him as well. Because with the Patriots, you don't hear people extolling New England's pass rush and blitzes and go, oh, they're coming after them. Even though the Patriots do that probably more than you guess, they don't do it a lot. Baltimore, that's what's going to be the story. If you put on the film, not put on the film, you watch them on TV, the announcer's going to talk about all the blitzing. They're going to talk a little bit about Matt Judon. They'll probably talk a lot about Calais Campbell if he's playing well. You don't think of Baltimore as a coverage-oriented defense, but that's what you're asking about.
All right. That's going to be a wrap for the show. I do just want to mention, and I missed it. I tried to screen grab it, and I was too slow, but
Did we pick a defensive guy, though? We don't think we settled one. I think the answer is TJ Watt.
Okay. Well, I also think TJ Watt. Now let me make my point about what I just missed out on here. I don't think I've ever seen you sit like that before during our show, where we have the video conference here going, we have Zoom going, and you were very close to your camera, but you were sort of looking off to the side, so it was like a profile, and you were just, the light was hitting you perfectly. It was a work of art there.
It was,
and I tried to screen grab. I couldn't get it in time. We have the nice scene with the pine trees in the background, and
yep, that's
really
actually
nice.
That is one single pine tree, because I live in the city here, so there aren't a lot of pine trees. The mountains are not far from here, but the guy who owned this house before us planted a Christmas tree for his son 45 years ago and never cut it down. So now we have a Christmas tree that it's easily 40 feet tall. Easily, it's huge. And I've been told the tree actually is illegal. Like, it's not, if someone took an issue with it, they got to cut it down. It's not, you know, it's not natural to this area. It's not an indigent tree. I would not have a case.
Wow.
But it blocks the neighbor's house. And so we both, the neighbor and I, you know, we both appreciate it.
Yeah. No, it's very nice. I've enjoyed that tree for years. And very good news. Shelby Royston, our producer, just chimed in here that he is video recording. He is. So he's got this shot.
Well, I forget that the camera's on, so I've been sitting off to the side, and I look up, and I see an empty spot of my window behind me, and I realize I have not been on camera for you. Even though we do this to build a rapport and look at each other when we're talking, thinking that makes us a better communicator, I don't actually look at you when you're talking. I look out.
No. We might as well just do this independently and then have Shelby patch it together and same chemistry, but...
Yeah, especially if we're going to skip your intros again.
Yes. That was...
If I'm allowed to just start talking, I would prefer that. And that I'll just send in my audio.
Incredibly rude. It was fine.
All right.
All right, Andy. That's a wrap. We got one more to go here in the division preview series. We already did the guessing game. It's the NFC North coming next week, and then we'll have some season preview stuff after that.
Sounds good.
The MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast is me, Gary Gramling. Special thanks to Andy Benoit for joining me for this one. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Ben Eagle is director of editorial projects and product. Mark Mravick is emeritus editor of the MMQB. Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL Podcast. Keep up with our entire lineup of podcasts 5 days a week by subscribing to the MMQB NFL Podcast for free on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, please do us a favor and leave a rating and review. It really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.
Six months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. It prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Life comes with big money questions. Is it better to max out your 401k or put more in a brokerage account? Does buying a home make financial sense in today's market? Should you use extra cash to pay off debt or invest? NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast has the answers. Their finance journalists break down investing and budgeting strategies to help you build wealth and navigate major financial decisions. Make smarter money moves. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you listen.